sorry.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The window of opportunity to avert the worst impacts of the climate crisis is closing, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohamed warned environment ministers and others meeting in the Democratic Republic of the Congo on Monday. The capital city, Kinshasa, is hosting key talks ahead of the COP27 UN Climate Change Conference in Egypt next month. Ms. Mohamed stressed that greater support for climate adaptation in developing countries must be a global priority, particularly progress on adaptation finance. She recalled that at last year's COP26 conference in Glasgow, developed nations had promised to double adaptation support to $40 billion a year by 2025. The UN Deputy Chief called for a clear roadmap on how the funding will be delivered starting this year. She added that $40 billion is only a fraction of the $300 billion that developing countries will need annually for adaptation by the end of the decade. Staying in Africa, the economic slowdown on the continent will push an additional 58 million Africans into extreme poverty this year, adding to the 55 million already there due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The stark assessment is among the findings in the latest report by UN Trade and Development Body UNCTAD, published on Monday. Following a 5.1% rebound in 2021, Africa's economic activity is expected to expand by a moderate 2.7% this year and 2.4% in 2023, according to the report. Meanwhile, almost 60% of Africa's low-income countries are already in debt distress or at high risk of it, as both private and public debt reach record levels. This comes as 60% of African countries overall require food assistance as hunger spreads. Some African economies have benefited from the return of tourism, while fuel exporters have enjoyed rising energy prices, boosting revenue, the report said. However, the economic situation remains difficult in most places. Finally, countries must do more to halt deforestation, plant trees to make the planet greener, and use forests and trees sustainably, the head of the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, said on Monday. FAO Chief Dongyu Qiu was speaking in Rome at the opening of the latest session of the UN Agency's Committee on Forestry. Mr. Qiu told participants that deforestation and land degradation, together with biodiversity loss, are devastating the world's ecosystems. He said halting deforestation is key to tackling the climate crisis by both cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 14% and safeguarding more than half the Earth's terrestrial biodiversity. Meanwhile, planting more trees helps to restore degraded land, while using forests and trees sustainably contributes to carbon neutrality and improved food security. Deanne Penn, UN News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as Puerto Rico struggles under another natural disaster, we're seeing some recognition of what's unnatural about the conditions the island faces that determine its ability to protect its people. We're even getting some critical mumblings about finance bros, people from the states who go to the island to exploit tax laws designed to reward them wildly. New York Magazine described a wave of mostly white mainlanders that, quote, has moved to Puerto Rico, buying real estate and being accused of pushing out locals who pay their full tax burden, close quote. Got to get that passive voice in there. But of course, it isn't just that these tax giveaways favoring non-Puerto Ricans are gross and unfair. You have to acknowledge in the same breath that money going to them is money not going to Puerto Rico's energy systems, schools, hospitals, housing, We'll talk about the harms inflicted on Puerto Rico that have nothing to do with hurricanes with Julio Lopez Verona, co-chief of campaigns at the Center for Popular Democracy. Also on the show, Customs and Border Protection released findings from an internal investigation a few months back declaring that no horse-riding Border Patrol agents actually hit any Haitian asylum seekers with their reins as they chased them down on the southern border last fall. That finding is disputed, but consider the premise that people would need to create tales of horror about the treatment of Haitians at Del Rio, where people were shackled, left in cold cells, denied medicine, and separated from children as young as a few days old. Corporate media subtly underscore that skepticism. AP ran an article at the time telling readers that the appalling images from Del Rio shocked everyone. Quote, "But to many Haitians and Black Americans, they're merely confirmation of a deeply held belief. U.S. immigration policies, they say, are and have long been anti-Black. The Border Patrol's treatment of Haitian migrants, they say, is just the latest in a long history of discriminatory U.S. policies and of indignities faced by Black people, sparking new anger among Haitian Americans, Black immigrant advocates, and civil rights leaders." Close quote. Understand, then, the racism in U.S. immigration policy is a mere belief held by Black people, and only they are upset about it. And this dismissive, divisive view is good, sympathetic reporting. We'll get another grounded perspective from Gerlin Joseph, founder and executive director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance. That's coming right up. You are listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Puerto Rico is in dire need of fuel for generators as they deal with the devastation of Hurricane Fiona. But a ship carrying fuel has been idling offshore, unable to enter a port because it's Puerto Rico, where the Jones Act, requiring that all goods be brought in on a U.S.-built ship owned and crewed by U.S. citizens and flying the U.S. flag, makes critical goods more expensive, or in this case, out of reach. The White House has just announced it will temporarily waive the Jones Act. Investment firms in mainland states can't act as advisors to the government in the issue of bonds while at the same time marketing those bonds to investors, but they can in Puerto Rico. In Puerto Rico, you can get tax breaks, including zero income tax on capital gains, unless, that is, you were born on the island. Only non-Puerto Ricans qualify. Puerto Ricans themselves are ineligible for supplemental security income, even though they pay payroll taxes. All of which is to suggest that the story of Puerto Rico's ability to prepare for, withstand, and recover from natural disasters starts long before the storm. We're joined now by Julio Lopez Verona, co-chief of campaigns at the Center for Popular Democracy. He joins us by phone from San Juan. Welcome back to Counterspin, Julio Lopez Verona.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there are a number of ways you could illustrate the tangle of predatory policy and political disempowerment and just exploitation that are the ongoing crisis for Puerto Rico before and after any natural disasters. But I know that you worked recently looking at how that all plays out in one very important sector, pharmaceuticals. What did that research show about how things work in Puerto Rico?
We have been interested in looking at how the colonial economy of Puerto Rico plays out in different sectors for a while. We've been specifically interested in thinking about how pharmaceutical companies are, in many ways, doing what they said they would do with the billions of dollars that we give them every year through tax exemptions. This is part of a decades-old practice to give billions of dollars of tax exemptions to pharma, which has phased out in many cases because of changes in our economy, but still remains. And we were interested in thinking through how these tax exemptions were actually helping communities have a good life, how if they were allowing people to actually have a dignified salary and all those things. And when we dug in, we started talking to workers in the security and cleaning space. And in those cases, we found thousands of workers that in many cases were subcontracted by pharmaceutical companies and were getting paid minimum wage, had the baseline of benefits that Puerto Ricans get. And it was really interesting for us because the pharmaceutical company for a long time had been sold as parallel to the American dream, the Puerto Rican dream. This is how you go get out of poverty. This is how you have a family. But we find these thousands of workers that are actually not doing that. And it brings about the question on what is the economy and why are we providing these tax exemptions when they are not benefiting Puerto Ricans? And, more importantly, who are they benefiting? Why are we continuing to do this? And why are we not being able to take advantage of the billions of dollars that could be put for our economy? And more in moments like this one, where we have hurricanes happening and where we have people struggling with issues with relocation, issues with droughts and flooding. In the case of Hurricane Fiona specifically, we have workers that we've been talking to that lost their homes while working on these pharma companies that say that they've been the first ones to kind of step up after the hurricane. So we have a really interesting moment where pharma says it's ready, but we have thousands of workers that are struggling in a moment of crisis.
Well, in some ways, it sounds very familiar to the kind of promises that companies make here on the mainland as well, that, give us these tax breaks and we'll create all these good jobs that will lift people out of poverty. And there's often very little follow-up to see whether they're actually creating that many jobs to begin with before you even get to whether their wages are actually really lifting people out of poverty.
Yeah, we often say that Puerto Rico has become a microcosm for the worst kind of experiments on capitalist ideas. We've seen those ideas be translated into extreme privatization, like what's happening right now with the electrical grid, which still is not able to provide electricity to all Puerto Rican families like 12 or 13 days after Hurricane Fiona. We've seen the impact of what you were referring a little bit earlier around tax exemptions for the rich, and this idea of trickle-down economics, like the rich come and everybody's better. And then we've seen what's happening with all of these corporations. Pharma is a great example, but we also know that Puerto Rico has the highest density of Walmarts and Walgreens, and those companies are also displacing Puerto Rican local companies. So all of the things that neoliberalism has preached for a long time that are the way in which you make capitalism flourish are happening in Puerto Rico. And in many ways, the agenda is one that has been accomplished successfully. It's really good if you have money. It's really, really bad if you're a person that doesn't have money and isn't able to take advantage of all the programs that benefit the wealthy.
And isn't able to jet away to your second home when a hurricane comes. Well, part of the misery yet again for Puerto Ricans, which was a CNN, part of a CNN headline, part of that narrative is Puerto Ricans are in such a perennial hole because they can't pay off their debt. Now, we can't do the long version of this necessarily, but I just don't know that you could get into an elite media conversation by explaining that, in reality, Puerto Rico has paid any debt that it rightfully owed long ago. Yeah.
I would even say, even if we simplify very much, there is a historical reason why Puerto Rico was in its debt crisis, and it is at the center of it because of colonialism. Puerto Rico's economy has been controlled by the U.S. since the U.S. came to Puerto Rico. If you look at the change in the way in which we use, like we went from our own currency to U.S. currency. That benefited people from the U.S. when we see the changes that happened when it came to the crops that were used in the 20s. And then when we looked at pharma and the companies that came or the military invasions, there are many examples of how Puerto Rican economy has been driven by the interests of the U.S. So even if we argue that the final result of this was that there was a debt crisis that was made in Puerto Rico, that would not tell the whole story. And even if you told that story, you should also account for the fact that this debt in many cases was illegal. This debt in many cases, as you said, was already paid, and that the people that are currently negotiating that debt are the same people that in some cases made money out of it. So it's a very, very complex situation that at the end has to do with colonialism, economic control of Puerto Rico's future, and greed. Greed in the worst way possible. Greed when it comes to hedge funds that decided to come to Puerto Rico and knowing that Puerto Rico would default and extract as much debt as they could, and greed when it came to the people that were running Puerto Rico and decided that they wanted to move forward with an agenda that at the end of the day was extremely good for those that had money, which is kind of a theme in this conversation, and really, really dire for people that live here and in some cases have been driven out of Puerto Rico because of those economic conditions.
Well, finally, when we've spoken before, it seems we always come around to talking about dignity, to talking about leading with the dignity of human beings in the policies that we make. And I just wanted to add, you know, there is, when you learn about what's happening in Puerto Rico, you see that it's beyond pushback to each new indignity. There is long-term organizing and growing happening that provides a way to at least look forward. Isn't that true?
Yeah, 5 years ago when Hurricane Maria happened, everybody talked about Puerto Rico se levanta or Puerto Rico rises up. This time, after Hurricane Fiona, people are talking about solo el pueblo salva el pueblo, so only the people save the people. People understand that what's happening in Puerto Rico is wrong. People understand that we cannot trust the government anymore and that we need to organize and support each other. We've also been gotten to the point where resiliency is not a good word. Resiliency is actually a bad word. What Puerto Ricans want and deserve is respect. They deserve a voice in the decisions that are made about their economy and their future. And they deserve, in many cases, reparations. They deserve that the people that have put us in this position step up and actually allow us to have the resources we need so that we can rebuild ourselves without the oversight of anybody, but with the power of the people at the center of the conversation and the actions taken.
We've been speaking with Julio Lopez Verona, co-chief of campaigns at the Center for Popular Democracy. They're online at populardemocracy.org. Julio Lopez Verona, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners will remember the pictures, U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback wielding reins like whips as they corralled and captured Haitian asylum seekers along the Rio Grande. The appalling images might have served as a symbol of the ill treatment of Haitians escaping violence and desperation. Instead, elite media made them a stand-in so that when the report came that despite appearances, the Border Patrol didn't actually whip anyone, one felt that was supposed to sweep away all of the concerns together. Well, there are serious problems with that report, but we should also ask why we saw controversy about photographs foregrounded over the story of Haitians' horrific treatment at the hands of U.S. border officials, treatment that a new Amnesty report, echoing others, describes as amounting to race-based torture, and why were media so quick to look away. The question is as vital a year on as reporters talk about other asylum seekers as political pawns and victims, but continue their relative disinterest in Haitians, tacitly sanctioning the harms of U.S. policy. Joining us now to talk about this is Gerlyn Joseph. She is founder and executive director of Haitian Bridge Alliance. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Gerlyn Joseph.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Chris Magnus, announcing the results of the agency's internal investigation in July, said, quote, "Not everyone's going to like all the findings, but the investigation was comprehensive and fair," close quote. He said that because the investigation said that there was no evidence that agents on horseback hit anybody with their reins. So it's as if he's saying, I know you wanted there to be real cruelty here, but there wasn't, so ha. But beyond that deflecting message that some people just want to believe in cruelty, the problems with the CPB's report about what happened in Del Rio, those problems are deep, aren't they?
Absolutely. First of all, what they did with the report is that they took the lives of over 15,000 Haitians and people of African descent and Black asylum seekers, and they put that into a 30-minute period where that picture was captured. But the reality is, if that picture wasn't captured, they would have told us this never happened at all. But we all saw the pictures, and we understood the reality under the bridge. And if you zoom into the picture, you will see the CBP officer on horseback, his hands holding and pulling the Haitian man by his shirt. And this man was only carrying food to his wife and child. So the report is telling us this didn't happen, but all you have to do is zoom into the picture, and you will see the intent, and you will see the fear, you will see the power that this officer had upon the person of this asylum seeker. Now the report will tell you that they looked into it, and they found that he did not whip the gentleman. But you can clearly see his motion to whip him. And you can see the fear even in the face of the horse that almost trampled this man who was carrying nothing but food. In addition to that, the report failed to interview or speak to any of the people who were under the bridge, any of the witnesses, and any of those who were actually experiencing the abuse. We made available to them Haitian migrants who were under the bridge. We made available to them advocates on behalf of the people we saw in that picture. And the reality that the world finally witnessed under the bridge, none of them were interviewed, contacted, or they even reach out to them. In addition to that, they still had 15,000 people in their custody, yet they didn't even care to speak to any one of them about the treatment they received, the abuse that we witnessed. Nothing.
Well, the idea of producing a report about what happened at Del Rio without talking to any of the asylum seekers, I think a lot of folks would find absurd on its face. And I would just note that in addition to the fear and the obvious violence that one can see in the picture, my understanding is that folks who were there say that there was, in fact, if this is what we're going to talk about, in fact, there was actual use of reins as whips, that is something that actually happened, which perhaps we would know about if the report had interviewed any actual asylum seekers.
Absolutely. If they cared enough to find the truth, if they cared enough to have a report that reflected the reality of the people who were subject to that abuse, they would have been able to identify what exactly happened. But they did not care enough to look or interview. They did not care to get the truth. What they cared about is how do we tell the American people, the American public, how do we tell the world that what you saw never happened?
Mm-hmm. Now, is the supposed rationale for turning away Haitian asylum seekers, is it continuing to be Title 42, this supposed public health policy? Is that the reason that the administration is still giving for turning away Haitians?
Yes. So at this present moment, the border is completely closed due to Title 42. There is no way for people to have access. Nobody can just go to a port of entry and present themselves to ask for access to asylum. As we are speaking right now, the border is completely closed due to Title 42, which is a health code that was put in place by the previous administration under President Trump, that was created by Stephen Miller as a way to completely take away any avenue for people seeking safety, people seeking protection, people seeking asylum to have access to due process at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, listeners will have been hearing about Republican governors flying people around and about. In that story, asylum seekers' treatment is portrayed as obviously political. But Del Rio was just sort of official policy, if regrettably handled. You know, we're not supposed to think about there being politics there or those people being pawns or victims in the same way somehow.
Actually, you know, it is because, first of all, a lot of the people received false information that if they had gone to Del Rio, they would be giving access to protection.
Mm-hmm.
So 15,000 people did not just show up overnight by themselves. Now, the source of that information or the source of that misinformation must be investigated. And that is another thing we also asked for the government to investigate the source of the misinformation that then guided people to where they were under the bridge. So why I say that, I see it also, that could have been a political plot. We don't know how that happened. However, we saw the moment the people who were there were black, we answered with violence. Now, is it political? I'll say yes, because our system is rooted in anti-black racism, is rooted in white supremacy. So therefore, the moment the black people showed up, we responded with violence, and we deported them, including pregnant women and infants as young as just a couple of days old.
And it's just not possible to consider that treatment, that reception of Haitian asylum seekers, out of context with the reception that we've seen given to other people. You know, I mean, it's impossible not to see that context.
Absolutely. I mean, the reality is, and one example, clear example, is how we as a country were quick to put a system together to respond and receive people fleeing Ukraine, right, with compassion and respect and love and dignity. And what we are saying is that same system that was put together overnight to be able to receive 26,000 Ukrainians in less than 2 months should not be the exception to the rule, should be the norm. It should be that while Haiti is in the middle of what the United States government is calling on the verge of a civil war, putting Haiti on a high risk, right, saying that it is very close to a war zone, we still deported 26,000 Haitians to Haiti in the middle of the crisis. At the same time, received 26,000 Ukrainians. Now, what we are saying is that the same way we are able to welcome the Ukrainians in crisis with compassion, love, dignity, humanity, it should be provided to people no matter where they are from, their ethnicity, the country of origin. Definitely should not matter whether they are black or white.
Well, we're going to end on that note. We've been speaking with Gerlyn Joseph, founder and executive director at Haitian Bridge Alliance. Gerlyn Joseph, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's newsletter, Extra, or to show support for the show if you are so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the back seat too. Made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? We'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. Just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two. See some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running, for red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power, the roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away. Or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while, but I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright, behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
And what a great show it is. I mean, you need to tune in tomorrow. Weather on Wednesday on Radio Free Kansas. It is really important. And, by the way, you get a bonus with Maria Gallardin's TUC Radio, all coming at you tomorrow. Thank you for listening. Here is the latest headlines from today's Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has formally ruled out direct peace talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin after the Kremlin declared it had annexed four Ukrainian territories seized by Russia's military. Earlier today, Zelensky signed a decree stating talks with Putin over Ukraine's fate would be, quote, impossible, adding, quote, we're ready for a dialogue with Russia, but with another president of Russia, unquote. This comes as Ukraine's military continues to claim battlefield victories. In the east, Ukraine's military is advancing toward the Russian-held Luhansk region after its troops recaptured the city of Liman on Saturday. Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces reportedly retook territory along the Dnieper River in the south on Monday. In Afghanistan, the death toll in last week's attack on an educational center in Kabul has risen to 53, with more than 110 people injured. Most of the victims were young women and girls. On Friday, a suicide bomber struck inside the building as hundreds of students studied for a university entrance exam. It was the latest attack on the minority Hazara community, which has repeatedly been targeted by the ISIS-K militant group. Over the weekend, Afghan women took to the streets of Kabul and other cities to protest the killing. In response, Taliban soldiers fired warning shots over the protesters' heads, smashed some of their cell phones, beat them, cursed at them, and forced them to disperse. This is Asia Askari, the older sister of Abanin, one of the students killed in Friday's bomb attack.
We are really worried. It's hard for us. All the schools are closed to girls. In the educational center, an unfortunate incident happened. Not only was Al-Banin martyred, but also Samira, Zara, and the security guard named Tahir, who are all like members of our family and served to protect us in the educational center. It is a very painful scene, but we will continue with the lessons, and we will never give up or stop.
Iran's Supreme Court leader has made his first public comments about the death of Mahsa Amini, the 22-year-old Iranian Kurdish woman who died after she was detained by Iran's so-called morality police for allegedly wearing her headscarf improperly. Speaking to military cadets at a graduation ceremony in Tehran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei on Monday labeled nationwide protests that have broken out over Amini's killing as riots. He blamed the United States and Israel for organizing them.
I say this clearly, that these riots and insecurities were designed by America and the usurping and fake Zionist regime. They have sat down and planned this. They have planned this. And those who take their salaries, some being traitorous Iranians abroad, have helped them.
On Monday, President Biden said he was gravely concerned about the intensifying violent crackdown on peaceful protesters, while promising to impose further costs on Iran. On Monday, Canada announced new sanctions against senior Iranian officials, while Germany and other European countries submitted more than a dozen proposals for the new European Union sanctions on Iran. Mass protests in Haiti are continuing for a seventh week to demand the resignation of the U.S.-backed Prime Minister Ariel Henry and to condemn rising fuel prices.
We are in the streets to say that we cannot breathe because of the high cost of living. Today we are in the streets to say that we want our dollars. Today we are in the streets to say that we do not accept the increase in price of fuel because fuel is a significant product. If we add 1 cent to its cost, then the price of all products will triple or increase fivefold. As long as Prime Minister Ariel Henry does not give up power, we will continue to fight.
The ongoing protests in Haiti have shut down many parts of the country. Meanwhile, Haitian authorities have announced 8 people have died from cholera, the first cholera deaths in Haiti in 3 years. A cholera outbreak over a decade ago killed over 10,000 people in Haiti. In Somalia, at least 20 people were killed Monday in a pair of car bomb attacks. The militant group Al-Shabaab took responsibility, claiming the attack in the central city of Beledweyne killed Somali government officials and soldiers. The violence came after the U.S. military said it killed the leader of Al-Shabaab in an airstrike Saturday. U.S. Africa Command says its initial assessment showed Abdullahi Nader was killed while no civilians were injured in the strike 230 miles southwest of the capital, Mogadishu. This comes after the Pentagon claimed in an annual report published last week U.S. forces killed only 12 noncombatants in 2021. The War Monitoring Group Air Wars accused the Pentagon of vastly undercounting civilian deaths, noting it documented up to 25 civilians killed by the U.S. last year in Syria alone. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot and killed two Palestinians and injured a third Monday as they drove their car near a checkpoint outside the city of Ramallah. Israel's military accused the young men of plotting to carry out a car ramming attack. The families of the men dispute Israel's account, saying the soldiers opened fire on their vehicle and killed them in cold blood. This comes as the EU-Israel Association Council is holding its first meeting in a decade today. Ahead of the talks, Amnesty International said in a statement, quote, Israel's committing the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. This is a crime against humanity, requiring the EU to hold Israel's leaders to account and to ensure it in no way supports their apartheid system. Any cooperation must focus on dismantling Israel's cruel system of oppression and domination, Amnesty said. Meanwhile, Palestinian leaders are condemning a proposal by Britain's new Prime Minister Liz Truss to move the United Kingdom's embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So far, the U.S. is virtually alone among nations in recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital after then-President Trump relocated the U.S. embassy there in 2018. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya spoke from Ramallah Monday.
Any change in the status quo in Jerusalem would undermine the two-state solution and will be considered a tacit recognition of the city's annexation to Israel, which will encourage the occupying state and the settlers' radical groups to continue their aggression towards our people and toward the Islamic and Christian holy sites in Jerusalem.
Japan's government has condemned North Korea's military after it test-fired a ballistic missile over the Japanese island of Hokkaido, triggering an emergency alert for 5 million residents, who the missile reportedly flew for nearly 3,000 miles before crashing into the Pacific far to the east of Japan, which would make it North Korea's longest test flight of a missile to date. This comes after Japan and South Korea joined trilateral U.S.-led naval war games last week in the waters off the Korean Peninsula. President Biden visited Puerto Rico Monday, where he pledged U.S. disaster relief 2 weeks after Hurricane Fiona collapsed the island's electrical grid with high winds, storm surge, and heavy flooding. Speaking from the port of Ponce on Puerto Rico's southern coast, Biden pledged to send every single dollar promised to Puerto Rico by the federal government.
We know that the climate crisis and more extreme weather are going to continue to hit this island and hit the United States overall. And as we rebuild, we have to ensure that we build it to last. We're particularly focused on the power grid.
Biden pledged $60 million in additional funding to shore up Puerto Rico's levees, fortify flood walls, and create a new flood warning system. His pledge came as FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell said the cost of repairing Puerto Rico's electrical grid would require billions of dollars. Tomorrow, Biden tours parts of Florida devastated by Hurricane Ian. The storm's death toll has topped 100, with search and rescue crews on warning they're likely to uncover more bodies in hard-hit parts of Florida's Gulf Coast in the coming days. The University of Idaho has warned its employees not to discuss contraception with students or to provide reproductive health counseling at the risk of being fired and charged with a felony. Since the Supreme Court's ruling in June that overturned federal abortion rights under Roe v. Wade, Idaho has seen nearly all abortions outlawed under a so-called trigger law passed in 2019. Last week, the university's general counsel wrote in an email to faculty and staff, officials will also enforce a law dating back to 1867, when Idaho was a territory, making it a crime to advertise abortion services and birth control. Civil liberties groups have condemned the guidance as a violation of free speech on campus. Adam Steinbo is an attorney with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
The First Amendment protects the rights of university faculty at public universities and colleges to discuss matters in class that are relevant to the class. The First Amendment protects that. And if you were telling them that if they are seen to promote abortion in their class or academic work, they could wind up in handcuffs, that's a First Amendment problem.
And in sports news, a year-long independent investigation has documented systemic abuse of players at all levels of women's soccer, including the National Women's Soccer League. The lead investigator was Sally Yates, who briefly served as acting attorney general. In a statement, Yates said, quote, "Our investigation has revealed a league in which abuse and misconduct, verbal and emotional abuse and sexual misconduct, have become systemic, spanning multiple teams, coaches, and victims." Yates went on to say, quote, "Abuse in the NWSL is rooted in a deeper culture in women's soccer, beginning in youth leagues, that normalizes verbally abusive coaching and blurs boundaries between coaches and players," unquote. The independent investigation comes a year after two coaches in the National Women's Soccer League were fired over abuse allegations. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Top of the hour with John Grant Live.
Mm-hmm.
maybe not. That's okay. We got a lot more to go. John Grant at the top of the hour. Call in. Area code 646-716-8652. Let's talk crime. We've got it. We've got it today. I'm telling you right now, here on Tuesday, This can't be happening radio. We have it. We have it. We have it. It is John Grant. I'm telling you, folks, there is nothing better than listening to this old cuss who missed. He missed the hurricane. You missed the hurricane. I mean, I can't believe it. I was talking to Dave Lindorf just 2 days ago. He was out there walking around, looking at the clouds. He's like, you know, who knows? I mean, it could get bad in Pennsylvania. It could get bad in Pennsylvania. John Grant, what's the weather like?
Well, today is a soggy day, boy, soggy as ever. And it's rained all day yesterday. It's raining all day today. Everything is just saturated and waterlogged. I got a big pool in my backyard. And, you know, we needed the rain, so it's good. You know, it's saturating the ground really good, and the sun will come out, and it'll be good. And all of that came, you know, all of this is still, you know, the remnants of this monster storm. One thing about this storm, Ian, is that it was so geographically large. It was huge. So, all of its winds and rains and things extended really way out. So, once it hits land, it dissipates pretty quickly because of all the, you know, there's much more back pressure against, I guess, it, you know, against all the trees and buildings, et cetera, that slows it down, speeds. So by the time it got through Virginia and up into Pennsylvania, it was just, a windy rainstorm with gusts here and there and things. And that's what we're in. So we're still getting the end of that right now.
Oh, really? It's still going through. I guess.
Well, as I say, all of this days and days of rain is supposed to. Sun's not supposed to come out here until Thursday. And so it's that whole weather system, you know, that again has been broken down because it hit dry land and stuff, that, you know, just it's just, you know, wet, very, very wet. So we're soggy.
Well,
very, very soggy today.
Well, a lot of the myths, and maybe I don't know if they're myths, but I think, were there any tornadoes in the area or anything?
Well,
like
that's
that?
One thing. My dear wife, Luann, is terrified of tornadoes. She's always, we have an area we're going to go to when we hear the freight train coming down on us. But, we, you know, there have been freak tornadoes in our area, yeah. We even had an earthquake here once. Really, I mean, a small one. I was in my, you know, the two-car garage studio office I have behind my house, 60 feet behind the house. I'm in the upstairs room, you know, writing something, typing. And all of a sudden, it was like there was a giant elephant outside the building, rubbing his back against the building, scratching himself, shaking the building, you know. And I'm going, what the fuck going on here? So that was a very small earthquake. It's
man,
very disconcerting,
man.
You know, to be in an earthquake. I can imagine those terrible ones in L.A., you know, California. But this was just so subtle and small, but it was going like, whoa, something's up here. Anyway, that's we don't get much bad weather here, but, you know, we have little things like that. We're very lucky here. We're very lucky in Pennsylvania.
Yes, you are. You are.
Yeah.
But when it comes to weather,
we're not going to get flooded. There are some floodings here, but we're fortunate on high ground, so that in the cul-de-sac we live in, all the water goes down to all of our neighbors at the bottom. And so their crawl spaces are flooded, not ours. You know?
Well, that's the way it is here where I live.
Yeah, it's the luck of the draw. You know, you're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, the creeks flood, but the creeks are all below, down the road. You know, down the road,
right.
There's the creeks flood. And what we like, to me, I like it. I can't mm-hmm. say my wife or my family doesn't like it. But,
right.
But you know, when it floods, they right. can't go anywhere because everything, all the creeks are flooded.
Right, right.
You have to stay. You have to stay with the old man. And
there you go. Hang out with the old guy.
Now get out there and pick up those tree limbs. You know.
Yeah.
Quit whining.
Right.
And clean the toilets. Clean the toilets.
Well, you know, that becomes the attitude post hurricane, of course. But the problem, it would seem to me, about Fort Myers Beach, I think that's where the worst
oh,
hit.
Now, hey. Hey, well, you lived in Florida, John.
Where I lived in Fort South. Myers? My brother currently lives in Naples. And so he was lucky. He's a bit inland. And in a little development, not the fanciest, but it's becoming fancy because now they're tearing down old houses that are perfectly good and putting up these huge mansions, one right next to him. But he's lived there for, 30, 40 years. And that area is 14 feet elevation. He told me it's 14 feet elevation. Well, if I'm correct, literally, the highest point in Florida is like 14 feet, something, 15 feet, something like that. You know, the state is virtually, you know, sea level up to 15 feet. 15 feet's a hill and a mountain in Florida, you know. And when this thing hits, huge hurricane hits, you know, the first dry ground it hits is going to get really, really battered because in process of battering the place, it's slowing the thing down. So by the time it got to Orlando, it was a tropical storm where I also have relatives in Orlando. And by then it was a tropical storm with some flooding, you know, so they had some flooding, but nothing like, my God, what hit, you know, Fort Myers Beach. And a lot of problems in Florida, according to what I've been listening to, the path of Ian, they projected to go towards Tampa, which would be north of, you know, Naples and then Fort Myers and Marco Island and Sanibel Island and all this stuff. But at the last minute, it seemed to make a sort of right turn and went farther south, and so the eye hit Fort Myers and. My brother is just below that in Naples, so Naples got walloped pretty good too. And again, you know, the luck of the draw, my brother's house is 14 feet, so, you know, he has hurricane shutters. I think he made out just fine. Some of that stuff, I guess the problem I would think in Fort Myers Beach is the demoralization factor. It's just so goddamn devastating. It's, you know, hundreds of people's homes just literally turned into toothpicks, you know, with the modern construction that's so flimsy at times. You know, it just, you know, it looks like pickup sticks. Remember, we used to play that game pickup sticks back in the day. So Florida is a mess. And to me, and I raised this with my brother, he probably didn't like it, but what this is going to mean for the politics of Florida, because Florida politics are now probably, you know, with California, Texas, and Florida, you know, three of the most volatile political states, and especially now with Ron DeSantis egging for the presidency as the non-Trump, you know, he's on a path to, you know, to make political theater everywhere, you know. And so how is he going to, you know, as a good fascist would do, quote, make the trains run on time after a hurricane? A massive hurricane is just devastating.
He's fucked up. He can't do it. I mean, is he going to fight Mother Nature?
Well, that's what I mean. What is it going to happen?
Is he
going
to fight Mother Nature? Is he going to fight Mother Nature? My God. It's so obvious. Well, can we ship every Floridian to somewhere else?
Right.
I don't know.
Send them all to Martha's Vineyard.
I don't. Kansas does not want coastal elites. I'll tell you that right now. I've been trying to tell you that, and you don't understand that. We don't need any more people. We like open.
You don't need the coastal elite. Huh?
No, we don't need.
So
the
what?
Coastal
what?
Elite.
I've just been describing the tragic plight of coastal elites, and you have no empathy for them.
John, I've tried over and over. We've done this show. I've talked with you for years.
Okay.
You know, the weather's always better on the Philadelphia side of the street. You know, and I'm just sort of, yes, you could come here, but you'll probably have to work for about $1.75 an hour. And, and we have these people like Pompeo
right.
out of Coke
Your
Industries.
Your boys
and,
out there, yeah, right. Yeah.
And Governor Brownback. I mean, and it's an unrelenting
Kobach.
Fight.
Somebody named Kobach, I remember
Kobach,
him. Right?
Kobach, that.
I remember all
Chris
the personalities
Kobach.
Out there in Tech, Kansas. I almost called you Texas there. Right? Yeah.
Well, no, we're worse than Texas. But here's the thing.
Worse than Texas.
Well, because here's why we're worse in Texas. Out
right.
here, you get conservatives who will act like Nazis, you know,
right.
get elected.
Of course.
And then,
well, it's fashionable
then,
now. Yeah. Be a Nazi.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not anymore. I think what's happening is that they're all going underground now. They burrow
uh-huh.
in, dig
uh-huh.
in little their mud huts.
Like groundhogs under my hooch out back, yeah.
Yeah, we were talking to the Green Room listeners about his groundhogs. We have groundhogs. They come back from Washington, D.C., and they
uh-huh.
come back to Kansas, and they dig in like groundhogs.
Right.
Good comparison.
Make a nice little hovel there, yeah.
Yeah, say, well, they got, 10, 20, 30 people will give them some money, and then they got their pension plans. I mean, these guys just sit around and they're sick people, Nazis. They're Nazis. I don't know.
There are Nazis out
there.
These days, you know, it used to be, you call people Nazis and you go, well, that's you're hyperventilating. You're going not too far. But nowadays, you look around, you say, well. The Nazi label's not far off,
Right. Right. I mean, it's like, well, or theocrats. I don't know. I'm going to impose my religion and ram it
right.
down your throat.
Right.
I mean, it's like, yeah.
Of course, I think it was Chris Hedges and others said, when fascism comes to America, it will come through the Christian church. And there's a lot of truth in that. Yeah, well, that was Chris Hedges, not me. Yeah.
Oh well, you got to think of your neighbors. Make liberals cry.
Make liberals cry again. And I've just been reading this wonderful what's his name, David Shields, I think, book talking about. Really interesting to marriage and sex and all this kind of stuff. And he seriously talks about the idea of sadomasochism, not just something kinky in entertainment and there's Marquis de Sade and all that, but as an operating, psychological principle in our culture that is activated for certain purposes. And so my argument has been that there is an element of sadism on the right. They love the idea of just humiliating and kicking the shit out of liberals and leftists. They love to humiliate them, call them names. They make careers out of that, and ultimately you know, now you have Margaret, what's her name, Green? I forget her full name.
Margaret Taylor Green, and she got a divorce.
Yeah, wherever she's from. Is she from Florida?
She might be a dominatrix.
It's like
maybe
she's such an asshole that she's such a national asshole voice that you don't even know where the hell she's from, you know? She's just
I think
voice.
West Virginia, isn't it?
West Virginia. You know, nothing against West Virginia, but you did vote for her. But, you know, she's now said she's made the perfect leap, as was pointed out by somebody. She made a speech yesterday, I think it was, in which she said that the left is trying to kill her. That the left, we on the left are trying to kill people like her. So therefore, if you actually can get that idea going, you know, it justifies stand your ground, self-defense, and shoot the son of a bitch before they get you.
I listened to her. It was in Warren, Michigan this Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Warren, Michigan this Saturday. And she was saying, she was telling all these deplorables, or whatever you want to call them, podunk. I call them podunk proletarians. And they're
I like that
people.
Podunk's one of my favorite words. Podunk proletariat. I like that.
Proletarians, I'm one of them. And she was feeding. She was throwing red meat.
Oh, it
red
was
meat,
just
blood.
Bleeding red meat. She was throwing. Absolutely.
She was warming up Donald Trump before he came on in Warren, Michigan. And she was saying, the Democrats want to kill you. They want to kill you. If we have electric cars. But here's something important, John.
Uh-huh. Okay.
She was talking about the throb, the power.
Ah.
Also, in the same little three-minute speech, you can watch it. Of a Mustang, a V8 engine.
Oh, yeah. Right. You can feel that power under your sitting there. Rumbling up through your ass, up to your backbone. Oh, just that power.
My dirty thought.
Yeah.
This is my
huge engine.
I think she wants Donald Trump. She wants Donald Trump to piss on her. That's what
really?
I think she
Really? Well, you know, I'll have to think about
kinky,
that one.
I think she just got a divorce.
According to the Steele report, you know, the manifesto or the Steele, what is it, document, whatever they called it. Donald did, have young ladies urinate on him in the, I think it was on the, in the room that Obama slept in at the Moscow Hotel. Steele memorandum is correct, and of course the Steele memorandum has been battered and beaten down for the last 4 or 5 years until it's out of credibility, but nevertheless, you know, it could be true. We just don't know. I think it had something to do with why Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin had a press conference or had a discussion in Helsinki in which no one has any idea what they talked about, you know. To this day, it was the most bizarre meeting of two heads of state, you know. And I think they were talking about the P-tape. You know, it's like, okay, let's get down to it. What are you going to do with the P-tape? What do I have to do, you know, and all. Okay, we got that straight, thanks a lot. And then they left the room, you know. Of course, that's just, you know, speculation. We don't know what they...
Well, no, and actually, the Steele dossier has been disproven in many ways. And the guy who wrote it, I don't have his name. I can get it by the end
Steele.
Of the hour.
His name is Steele.
That guy is, I mean, you know, he did a great job.
He was trash. They spent, you know, 5-6 years trashing him. So, yes, it was very effective.
He'll never.
They didn't really disprove the P-tape charge. They just –
He worked for a guy that I have a I have a clip, a two-minute clip. Yeah. We're going to do clips from a guy named Jonathan Pye. Bear with me, listeners. John.
Boris Johnson is the most dangerously incompetent and untrustworthy
serial shagger who won't tell the press how many kids he's got because he's not entirely sure himself.
Boris went to Eton, a sort of Hogwarts for wankers.
Alexander Boris Jeffel Johnson, that's his actual fucking name.
A man who would rather pretend to be stupid than admit his mistakes, which of course makes him a coward. Was fired for lying about shagging someone behind his wife's back. Narcissist, only out for himself.
An egotistical charlatan.
Posh, upper-class, bumbling idiot.
I don't understand what the word party means. My willy just ended up inside my secretary. Jimmy Savile's fat, evil twin. Chris Tarrant on a comedown.
A man who took an 80-seat majority and just spaffed it up the wall. You fucked it, mate. He's resigned, but he hasn't fucked off. Hubris, incompetence, deceit, and shit hair.
Reshuffling cat shit on a litter tray.
A desperate, sad, talentless flag shagger. His arrogance and entitlement, they know no bounds.
Useless, posh, sliver of bollock skin.
I'd be happy with just his balls. The most hated man in his party and his country.
Boris Johnson would be the result if Greggs the Baker ever branched out into eugenics. Dismal, disloyal, disorganized.
Fuck up after fuck up. Lie after lie. Cannibals. Self-serving parasites. Tapeworms in tiaras, vicious right-wing populists.
With the appearance of an uncooked oven chip in a suit of a wounded balloon, a pickled intestine, a sack of vicious custard. Boris Johnson, an abducted Milky Bar kid, found 40 years later in a port cellar.
A Shakespearean tragedy written by monkeys on typewriters.
He's still fucking there.
Why don't you just fuck off, you entitled sack of minge? What a legacy. Chaos.
Blah, blah, blah.
Something Latin.
Leveling up.
Cockwomble. Selfish. Millionaire.
Flag shagger.
Disloyal.
Populist.
Fucking div.
The day I start taking lessons in morality from the likes of Boris Johnson is the day I start taking the fucking smack.
Boy.
Jonathan.
Boris Johnson is a liar.
Jonathan.
Let's keep it simple.
I tell you, that was quite a rant there. Yeah, I tell you.
I think, John, you and I need to work on that. I mean,
yeah, hard to keep up with a standard like that. That sets a high bar.
Well, I mean, he was saying goodbye to Boris Johnson.
I can see that. Yeah, right. Yeah. Serial shagger,
you know,
Boris there. Yeah.
I love
all those Britishisms like shagging and, you know, my favorite, of course, is, you know, when a young man asks a young lady for a date, he says, I'll knock you up at 7.
I'll tell you, I've been watching.
My wife comes in going, ha, 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 ha. She didn't think that was funny.
Well, she knows about it. She knows. I mean,
she must
know.
She just said that we need supervision.
Actually, we need counseling.
Counseling. I think that's what she meant.
Counseling. Oh, no. Oh, no. I think actually they
she's
actually... I go into my Downton Abbey. I go into my Downton Abbey thing when I visit with. When I go too far, I have to resort.
Oh,
to,
so I didn't know you had a very civilized Downton Abbey side.
Oh yes. I have to.
Are you like upstairs or downstairs? Where are you? You with the
downstairs.
Help or you? Sort of aspirations to lordship or what?
With my mother-in-law, I am always downstairs.
Downstairs.
I mean, yes, well, it's the mother. I mean,
uh-huh.
I have a mother-in-law mm-hmm. who has a pillow that says, it's embroidered. It's good to be the queen.
Oh, right, of course.
Yeah.
Well. She must
that's
like
a
that.
Living.
Yeah.
What do you mean she must like it? I think that's a message. I think it's
right.
A message to the servants is what it is. It's good to be queen.
I don't know why it reminds me of my dear grandmother Ma, my father's mother, who's a wonderful character in life. Well, she had an accident. Somebody ran over her, backed over in a car, and kind of messed her up. So she had, you know, many years. And my uncle and aunt and their family took care of her. And, you know, they'd take care of her, give her lunch and stuff. And she was blind at that point. And you go in there. I don't know why I'm reminded of this. And Ma, you know, wonderful Ma would be sitting there drinking coffee with a cup, white cup, with it said, bullshit on it.
No shit, really?
I always remember that was Ma. She's blind, of course. She doesn't know. She has this coffee cup. It says bullshit on it. I don't know why I remember that. You know, I don't know. What to,
well, that's
I love
why
my grandma.
You call in.
Yeah.
That's why you're, I mean, John Grant, you're here on Tuesday. This can't be happening. And I think that's why you're here. We're giving you counseling, the audience.
There may be some truth in that. You know, you have to sort of talk a lot, talk counseling. You know, so maybe you're like my counselor. Yeah, I don't know.
I've had. Believe me, I've been to counseling. I actually was incarcerated for a month.
That's the next step from counseling, incarceration.
I was locked up in let me put it more bluntly. In the true spirit of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Right,
you know,
perfect, yeah.
I was locked up in a nut house for about 30 days.
Really?
Yeah. It was on the glorious occasion of my first divorce.
A rough one, I guess.
And, well, it wasn't really rough. I just wanted to kill myself. But
ooh,
I mean,
yes. Not good. Yeah.
But I never really thought about it until after
right.
I got out of the nut house.
Okay.
And once I got out of the nut house, mm-hmm. and off the there was the incredible drugs they gave you. This is not marijuana.
You say incredible as if they're good?
Oh no! It was like what
they
I
zombified you.
A chemical lobotomy.
Well, there you go.
Chemical lobotomy.
So you can really appreciate. You can really appreciate One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I guess.
Oh yes, but I never picked up any lavatories or found a Native American.
Right. Well, you never. Did you have a big nurse they had to deal with?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it was a black African American nurse, but I mean, you know. No, it was what started out as a painful time
mm-hmm.
turned into a happy time, and the drugs were
wow. It must have been successful then,
Well, not really, because I had the psychiatrist. You know, in order to get, I did not know this until I was there mm-hmm. in the nut house that you have. A psychologist in Missouri and Kansas cannot give you drugs.
Uh-huh.
You have to be a licensed medical doctor, psychiatrist, or doctors. They can give you drugs.
Right.
Now, while I was in there, I was assigned a psychiatrist who I visited with, and
mm-hmm.
his last name. He was from Cuba, by the way.
Okay, wow.
And his last name was Batista.
Oh, my God.
And
no
I told
relation
him,
that
I,
you
know?
Or,
I'm telling you the truth. And I could, you know, I treated him like a doctor. I could tell
mm-hmm.
him everything. And
mm-hmm.
I said, I'm a communist. I'm sorry. I don't know how to give it up.
He had fled the island, of course, probably.
Well, he never told. He would never talk about.
That's the thing. They don't want to talk about themselves. They just want to know all about you.
No, right. Yeah.
But I think a psychotherapist.
No, wait a minute. He gave me.
Yeah, go ahead.
He gave me the most powerful drug that you, it would. It was a chemical lobotomy. It's called Stelazine.
Wow.
Stelazine. Yeah. And
I've heard of Thorazine. Yeah, maybe in that kind of thing.
And he wouldn't let me. He wouldn't let me out of the nut house until I promised to take that Stelazine. Well, I was taking it. You know, after I got out, he says, now you need to take more. You're outside the nut house.
Right.
Take more. So I took more, and one of my best buddies in my life came up and saw me at a law library drooling over law books.
Oh, my God.
And he helped me get my buddy got me.
Get you off the stuff, right?
Don't take Dr. Batista's medicine.
Right. <Jeez. clears throat> Yeah, that's
a true story. And he showed me in the what do they call it, the PDR?
Right, PDF. I think it's PDF. No, that's
PD. Yeah,
PDR. PDR. I guess.
Well, while I was drooling in the law library over books, he brought out the PDR or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
He showed me the picture of the pill.
Right.
And he says, you're taking this. And he showed me the pill. I said, yeah, I'm taking those. And he said, look at the side effects. Look at what happens.
Exactly.
This is my buddy. And he's like, that's where he told me, you have had a chemical lobotomy.
Right. Well, you know. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I just said, I think you're right.
Yeah, you could tell. Well, you know, a lot of people, when I get drugs, you know, you get this, you know, you get a sheaf of paper, God's 9 yards long, you know, with all the data and the tests, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it's been through. I would suggest that very few people read those things, you know what I mean? Whereas I tend to read them. Like I read, you know, I was taking oxycodone or one of those, you know, with the opiates in it. And I read the whole goddamn thing. You know, I read it very closely to see what they were saying. And you learn a lot about it, what you're taking, because generally you just don't know. Doctor gives it to you. You don't know what the hell it is. And, you know, some of these PTSD-ridden vets, you know, they're taking like 5, 6, 7 different pills, you know, they're like a vegetable half the time. I had a rack vet friend who was like that. My God, he was just, they were just zoning him out. The best decision he made, though, he was working as a parole officer, an armed parole officer with child molesters and things, you know, and he decided he had to quit that job. He couldn't go around as an armed parole officer dealing with the daughter that he had, dealing with these pedophiles. You know, he was afraid he was going to shoot one of these SOBs. So he very smartly, continued to take his drugs, I suppose, but he quit the job. He says, I am not a man who should have a gun. Very, very self-aware decision on his part. Anyway, he was taking all kinds of drugs. And there, you know, there's a story about the guy who was taking 12 drugs and he's zombified and decided this was ridiculous. And I think he moved to a more rural area where he had less stress and just started growing marijuana and taking that. It just mellowed him out, you know. And instead of taking all these other zombifying drugs, he was taking, marijuana, or apparently ecstasy works for
PTSD.
Well,
it worked, weed worked before and it worked after for me.
Mm-hmm.
I quit the chemical lobotomy route.
Right.
You know, I was like, it wasn't working out. And, I'm wondering how many in the population of the United States.
Right.
I mean, this Dr. Batista, you know, from Cuba, he gave, he was just like throwing this around like candy, you know.
Of course.
Yeah.
Right. You know, well, that's the way psychology went. I think it's changing.
Well, no, I think this African American woman, she was a nurse in the nut house.
Gotcha.
In the nut house, and I was playing cards with her one night. We were up late. I don't mean anything bad, but we were playing spades, and she told me, Mike, why are you in here? And I said, well, I wanted to kill myself. I felt bad about my divorce with my wife, and she said, you shouldn't be in here, Mike. You know, you're a good guy, and we spent a lot of nights. You know, she talked to me while we were playing cards, spades, and that was more. To me, that was more. That made me feel better more than Dr. Batista ever did with Kimmy.
Well, that's what I always say. You know, when you know, I've been told by some people, I'll remain anonymous, that I need counseling, I need therapy, I just need it so bad. You know, and I say, no, I don't look at it that way. I don't want to, you know, rely on somebody's information when I got to pay the son of a bitch $100 an hour, and when I'm getting down to the best part of it, say, okay, I'll see you next week, you know. That I don't think that helps, because I think that, to me, when that happens to me, that makes me feel even worse, because I'm not dealing with a person that really gives a rat's ass about me. You know, they just, you know, want to do their job, and they'll listen to you, and then you're off. Whereas I'd rather find a good friend who's wise, and or as you were, you know, just this woman you're playing cards with, you're just, you know, having a nice exchange with her, very human exchange, understanding exchange, and it's positive, you know, and you're not paying her, obviously, the institution's paying her. And, you know, so that's kind of my view of therapy and counseling. And so I think you hit it. You're right. That was the best therapy counseling you could have, not the drugs, but just having understanding, you know, random conversations with people, you know, that people that care about you, you know.
Well, companionship is a big deal, I think. You know?
Amen.
Yeah.
Well, that would seem to be the root of your problem anyway, because it involved marriage and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it was worse than that. I mean,
we don't need to go into your peccadillo.
No,
right?
I just want to tell you. I want to tell you about Murphy. What really caused me, it wasn't really the woman. It wasn't the woman. I mean, that was part of it. But it was a St. Bernard dog, a dog.
Right.
That really, really pushed me over the edge at that time. Uh-huh. Isn't that, his name was Murphy. He was a St. Bernard. And a detective from the Kansas City Police Department came over and told me, and very politely informed me, he says, Mike, your dog. And he was in the back room, the dog. And
Murphy?
Yeah, my dog, Murphy. And he says, you know, the neighbors are complaining that Murphy is not looking good. You know, he looks starved. He was starved. And I said, well, and I went through the whole thing about how she left me, and I'm painting the house, I'm doing everything I can to bring her back, and I said, I just don't have any money, you know, and it was all I could do to pay for the to paint the house. And And he says, but Murphy is, he needs help, Mike.
Right.
And then this is a detective. He's not a uniformed cop. He really was a nice guy.
Yeah.
And he came over a week later, and he says, Murphy, a week later, he says, Murphy is still looking bad, Mike. What are you going to do? What can I do to help you? And I said, and he took Murphy away. And it really broke my heart. That made it worse, and that's when I called the – and by the way, listeners, you really should do it. If you have a suicide hotline, you really need to take it. Just put your trust into somebody else, and hopefully, I'm not going to guarantee you anything, but hopefully, listeners, you'll understand that there are people out there who care and who know how to help you. You know.
Amen.
And that's
you just got to find them. Now, did you get Murphy back or?
No, I lost Murphy. Yeah, but that's okay. I've had a dozen dogs since then. You know,
right.
You know?
Yeah, just part
and
of
then
the
they all.
Sure.
You know, the good thing about it's tough. It is tough.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get a pet and you can watch them grow and get old and die, it helps you deal with the hardship of war, imperialism, the cruelty of people to other people,
just
including
the
your ex-wife.
Frustrations of life. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have my cat Charlie, who is in.
Oh, we have pictures of Charlie.
You know,
Charlie
can be an absolute pain in the ass. But, you know, I love him to death, and he is clearly an unlicensed service animal. You know, he's there, and he does it. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, animals are good.
And with that, I think it's good therapy. You got to learn that animals have emotions. That's a big thing for me. most Americans, most people do not understand that animals have emotions. They really do. And it took me a bit. I worked in several slaughtering houses, killing a lot of animals, thousands a day of animals. Yeah, chickens and pigs. And I learned that.
Yeah.
And it's just like that tribute to Boris Johnson that I just played with John F. Fye.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think many people, John Grant and listeners, I think many people need to sort of come in contact with the inhumanity of other humans. There are so many it's not just Putin. And I got to tell you, I think President Biden has probably lost a lot. I think he wants to be in contact in his humanity, but he's been through so much with his drug addiction of his son and the death of
his he's got the deaths of his children in several periods of his life.
I go every day. And, John, I know you're about, how old are you, 73, 74? What are you?
75.
Oh, my God, you're older.
Three quarters of a century old.
You're older than I thought you were, okay?
I'm an old goat, man. Trust me, I'm an old goat.
But, dude, you've got a great, great mind. And I publish your
story. Well, I try to keep it alert, you know? I mean,
I can only wish that.
If you read enough, study enough, and you're pissed off enough, you know, you have the energy, you have the reason to figure out what the fuck is going on. Like this memoir I'm sort of working on, I root my as a journalist, as a questioning individual, sort of poking around, curious, nosy, all that kind of stuff. I trace it back to being a 10, 11-year-old kid dropped into redneck South Dade County, Florida, from Pearl River, New York, a fine, liberal, upstanding, place in New York State, outside New York City, into this redneckville, there were bullies I had to deal with, and I'm trying to figure out what the fuck is going on here. WTF, man, is my mode. Like, you know, so I would pull back and I would be an observer to watch what was going on so that I could, maneuver my way through this crazy new social scene down here in Redneck South Dade County, Florida. you know, and I dealt with bullies. I figured out how to deal with bullies. You have to deal with bullies like the Munich principle with Hitler. You know, you can't, you got to get them early when they start fuck with you. Don't wait until they, you know, fuck with you for 6 weeks, you know. Get them the first time and just go ballistic on them. And they go like, this guy's a nutcase. I'm going to go over here and fuck with this guy over here. No, I'm not going to fuck with him anymore, you know. And so you learn and, you know, you observe and mind your own business and just try to figure out what's going on. And that became a mode, and it was a natural for journalism. You know, you have this idea, like, your mode of process is WTF, like, what the fuck, you know, is going on. Mm-hmm. And here we are. Now I'm who I am.
Well, I think you have to deal with bullies in a way.
Yeah.
Like, I really think this. I think what happened in England just last week is a good example of what you do with, you see, this is a problem. In America, we all individualize things. I know you agree with me.
Absolutely.
Noam Chomsky, everybody. But here is something unusual that has happened in England. Hold on.
Well, that would have been my first question to the Chancellor. You know, I'll get onto your mini budget shortly, but firstly, at Her Majesty's funeral, were you high on GAC, or do you need to see a mental health professional? Either way, I defy anyone to watch that video and think this guy is fit to run the economy. I'm always ready. The Chancellor's tax cut bonanza sent shockwaves. I'm not saying bonanza, because it makes it sound like a good thing. It's like saying Fred West's lady-killing jamboree, or a friendly get-together of cancer cells. Well, find an alternative. So who'd have thought it, eh? Liz Truss, the most right-wing prime minister in my lifetime, and that includes Tony Blair. That was a joke. And that includes Maggie Thatcher. And that's not a joke. Don't be fooled by her mousy disposition and disarming lack of charisma. Liz Truss is far more dangerous than you could possibly imagine. She should be feared. She is a fundamentalist, a born-again conservative, a sock puppet for the IEA and other sinister right-wing think tanks. And by the time she and her cabal of ideologues are kicked out of office, she may very well have bankrupted the nation. It's like they know they haven't got another election in them. So they may as well just go for broke, literally. They've had their decade in the sun, and now it's time for them to reap the rewards with one final game of class warfare, one last all-out assault, in order to combat the cost of living crisis that will force millions of hard-working families into poverty. The Tories have decided that we need tax cuts for the most wealthy and tighter rules on benefits for the poor. And with a straight face, they tell us that lifting the cap on bankers' bonuses is, and I quote, a key part of their levelling up agenda. It's as if the phrase gaslighting was invented for this very situation. The Chancellor tells us cutting taxes for people earning over $150,000 is fair for all, that these cuts favour people across the board. Lies! The reversal in national insurance will, for example, help the richest by £1,800 and will help the poorest by £7.66. We are not a poor country. Yet millions face a winter of destitution after a decade of mishandling of the economy combined with a summer of complete inaction followed by a big fat millionaire's trickle-down wank of a mini-budget, full of economic plans that Truss says she will pursue relentlessly. When has trickle-down economics ever worked for anyone other than those at the top? Well, the rich get richer, helping to stimulate growth and a healthy economy. What is the point of a healthy economy and growth if it pushes people further into poverty, forcing them to rely not on the welfare state, because that, of course, has been all but dismantled in its entirety, but instead relying on charity, on food banks. It's morally repugnant. If you're poor, if you're struggling, this government is here to punish you. The implication being that being poor is a choice. If you can't afford to heat your home, wrap yourself in a blanket. And if the cost of living crisis means you can't afford to live, well, frankly, the more lazy, poor, hungry, shitty little citizens that die this winter, the better, particularly if you're elderly, because then at least you won't be sponging off the state using up all that tax that rich people no longer have to pay. Liz Truss's government has little concern and zero compassion for the majority of people in this country. They don't care about you or your hungry children or your shivering granny or your kids rotting school or your 2-year wait for an operation. And if you look at the state of the economy this morning, you have to ask yourself, do they really care about that either? Because if they did, then how come the economy is in a worse state than my gusset after a nasty follow through? Help the rich. Fuck the poor, whilst curbing our rights to protest over what is frankly a sinister shift in policy without any mandate whatsoever. That is this government's agenda. What? No, that doesn't work. Let's just stick with Bonanza, shall we? I'm getting a bit chilly out here.
Wow.
The Chancellor's tax cut Bonanza
wow.
has sent shockwaves
wow.
across the market. The pound
is Who is this guy? Who is this guy?
All right, once again, listeners, Jonathan Pye, who is, he just released that one. That was a...
he's brilliant. The guy's brilliant. He's pissed, obviously.
Well, I think we should be pissed in America.
Oh, no question. He nails it. He really nails it. This idea of, and you can see this happening. We're going into very dire times in the future.
Yes.
And so these right-wing yes. governments are locking societies up so that the top will be protected and fuck the poor. You know, you can see
yes.
it happening. You can see it happening. And this guy really nails it. And it's easier to see in a smaller place like Britain, you know, which,
yep.
of course, was a huge empire at one time. Talk about make, you know, place great again. You know, well, there's no making
right.
Britain
yeah.
great again like it was. You know, the sun
right.
never set on the British Empire and all that crap. Well, now, you know, they're making themselves smaller and smaller and smaller as they're you know, the Queen just died. I mean, I think this government is using that. You know, the disruption, the profound disruption of this queen that's reigned for so absolute long and is beloved in a bit, you know, that they're using that epical shift, you know, as a distraction when they're doing this stuff. And, of course, they had to backtrack in Britain, you know, the black chairman of the Exchequer or whatever, the economist there, he gave a speech in which he ate crow yesterday and said, well, obviously we went too far. We have to back off on this. It's pretty amazing what she's done. You know, she's criticized after what? She's been in office 2 weeks or something?
They're reversing. Reuters
yeah.
news the major news, who knows if it's real. I think it's real. They're all,
mm-hmm.
they're, Liz Truss, the new prime minister,
right.
is backpedaling now because they impose these, they're not tax cuts.
Right.
They're giveaways to the wealthiest
right.
of people.
Right.
And in Britain, and we're talking literally a giveaway,
right.
and the revolt
right.
is so popular that
right.
it's not even the Labor Party, the
right.
so-called Democrat Party look-alike
right.
in America,
yeah,
the Labor Party is like going, oh my God, this is not going to work, and the markets have fallen, they've crashed.
Right. The
pound.
I don't know what whether it what it means, but you know what a truss is? Her name is
no.
Her name is Truss, right?
Yes,
a truss is a you know, like a jockstrap underwear that holds in your rupture. If you're ruptured down there, you know, you have a truss that is like a girdle for your rupture and your hernia that holds all your gonads and everything together down there. That's what a truss is. You know?
Well, I don't
really.
Think it's
I'm not kidding. You know.
No, but it's not working, John. That's
not working, right. My guts are hanging out still, you know, thank God. Oh, Jesus.
So, I mean, they're all back, they're running.
I know.
And there
well,
a,
you can see the same goddamn thing going on here, you know?
Here, yes, and there was a video of her, I think when she was campaigning to be
right.
Prime Minister, of her in a meeting saying, yes, we will use nuclear weapons.
Oh, well, hello.
Nuclear weapons over Ukraine. Over
yeah, well, I was just reading about Ukraine today a lot in the Times. And, you know, Putin is really, really fucked. He is painted himself in a corner. It's... You know, in the Donbass region, you know, they just the Ukraine's just took over Lyman, this railhead, and they're just on a roll. They're moving fast after Lyman, and apparently the Russians are fleeing, just running as fast as they can. And so, you know, this was after, you know, Putin had this big celebration declaring these provinces part of Russia, and that if Ukraine attacked, they'd be attacking Russian territory. Well, Ukraine said, well, fuck that, and did it anyway, and went in and kicked the living shit out of the Russians. And so, this man is desperate. And, you know, there was an article on all the thinking on the nuclear weapons, the tactical nuclear weapons, and that it seems unlikely that he will do it, because it will only open another bigger Pandora's box for him, and, you know, get worse and worse and worse. And in the end, he'll be destroyed. He may bring the world around his neck, but doing it, but he'll be destroyed in the end. I think he probably knows that. So that's a restraint on him. But then, you know, how mad is the man? You know, you wonder, and it's a pretty, pretty scary time when they're talking about dropping these tactical nukes, you know. And, you know, a lot of people say this is World War III brewing. You know, we watch World War I brew in history. We watch World War II brew in history. And there are some parallels, and it's, you know, getting pretty serious. You know. But it's out of the bag, you know. I mean, the left, many people on the left try to, you know, condemn the United States. Oh, we're in NATO and all this. We're expansive, typical United States arrogance and all this kind of stuff, which, you know, resonates with me. I understand that. But at the same time, you know, Russia is just, and Putin's Russia is just outrageous what they're doing. I suggested to one of my lefty friends who runs down the U.S. and praises Russia all the time about NATO, that why doesn't the American anti-war peace movement link with the Russian anti-war peace movement and make a big splash, you know?
Upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me, somewhere why can't I? If happy